Mostly I'm going to offer some kind of field notes that I hope will connect the gorgeous insights that you all were bringing in this morning with a kind of a narrative of the way, really, of our human way of enlightenment and enlightenment, our Buddha way, and maybe our way as humans connects, you know, as a the large humans in the large sense connects with this too. It seemed to me, and some of you may have had that same, a similar sense. And I'm not totally organized about this, so bear with me. Our tale begins where so many tales begin, with the longing for a birth, a child, for the vastness to appear on this earth in our human lives, to somehow redeem the darkness and bring the light. Apparently, Carl Jung commented this represents the strongest, most ineluctable urge in every being to realize itself, somehow to come to a sort of fruition, an incarnation of the inability to do otherwise, you know, to just, and so it reminded, that comment reminded me of what the Buddha is said to have said, yeah, waking up under his tree, that we're all already it, and somehow our human task is to realize that, to make it real on earth. So the comment here was that this yearning, this deep longing, I left this, stretches between the potential wholeness of the self, written big, and its actualization in the world of reality. Stretches, that this longing, this deep yearning, stretches between the potential wholeness of the self and its actualization in the world of reality. And this story, you all touched on it in so many ways, exactly that, you know, that this story kind of is that, from the seemingly pure beginnings of that longing for a perfect baby, and our actually becoming full human beings who can be living a human life. There's this longing also in the beginning that this numinous world, the world shot through with light and brilliance, might find life here without this kind of barren despair that sometimes we feel. That, you know, that word barren, you know, like a desert, although deserts are not, but anyway. And so the queen, out of that place, consults ancient wisdom. goes into the wilderness to find it. And the old woman says, no ill is without its remedy. And that so much reminded me of sickness and medicine correspond than what is the self. No illness is without its remedy because the remedy is in the illness, right? So, or as Trungpa Rinpoche says, and you've heard me quote this, that the very restlessness of the heart-mind is your Buddha nature. So she's looking for Buddha nature to show itself, and yet there she is. You know, it's already in her. But she doesn't know that yet. It's the beginning of a journey when we don't know that, right? And so her hope, which she didn't have, you know, she was in despair. And the old woman offers her hope to be saved from this sense of incompleteness that we have. To be saved by the vastness, you know, that the vastness will come perfectly as a light and save you, just like that. But the old woman says, you must choose. And that, and several of you touched on that, you have to make a choice. And a choice is a limitation, right? I get this or this. And when we, as we all do, refuse the limitation and prefer the fantasy that we can, in fact, have it all, then that's a kind of addiction. And several of you touched on that also, yeah? That there's a compulsive quality to it. And on the other hand, that also has its beauty, right? This is so beautiful, I want it all, right? So there's that side of it, and the other side of it is actually, probably can't have it all. And so you must learn to choose, to make a choice, to accept that there is limitation. But in that moment, so the unconsciousness of that I guess it might have been you, Kelly R., who touched on that, the unconsciousness of it. It's a not even noticing that you're not making the choice, that you're just going, right? Again, has both its beauty and its shadow side, which is addiction, yeah? I'll just have one more rose, one more drink, one more retreat. Or also the kind of self-soothing quality of it, where it's, I'll just let life decide for me. Anybody ever say that? Thinking that, in fact, I'm not making a choice, right? Denying that there is choice involved. And that, her doing that in the story, sets up the problem, doesn't it? It's like, uh-oh. We know bad things happen when you don't follow the old woman's advice. But is it a problem? And this reminded me a little bit of a couple things. The koan about the frogs and the crow, right? Dongshan down by the river washing bowls. Two crows fighting over a frog, right? It's only, and the other monk there says, must it always be like this? And Dongshan says, it's only for your benefit, Reverend. There's that, and there's also the koan about the mind seal of the Buddha down in, you know, the iron ox lying in the river. And the last comment in that koan being from a magistrate, right? From a governor type, saying when it's the magistrate's time to make a judgment, if he doesn't make a judgment, the people will suffer. Right? That's representing that same thing. Right? If you've really got the mind seal, if you've really fully realized, then when it's time to make a choice, you can make a choice. However, we're not there yet in our story. And there's this lovely quote from Isaac Rashiva Singer, who said, to me, God is freedom, and nature to me is necessity. Demons come when people leave free choice. If we stop completely believing in our power to choose, then other powers can come upon us. And that the essence of that sort of demonic quality is melancholy. Isn't that interesting? The refusal to choose leaves you with something undone, which shows itself as an underlying kind of melancholy. That's what addiction to the fantasy does to you. You get stuck that way. And so, sensing her melancholy, the old woman says also, you have to tell it, right? You have to speak it. Somebody touched on that also. Then when you speak it out loud, you might be able to sacrifice the fantasy and stop just seeking heavenly states. This, to me, really connected with our path of meditation and practice, because quite often, most of us, I think, enter the path of meditation thinking meditation is going to make me peaceful. Right? Bliss. And people always laugh about, you're so Zen, you know, or, oh, you must be blissed out. You've been meditating. You're like, right. And so if you are always blissed out when you're meditating, you're living in fantasy. You are making yourself go to a place where there is no trouble. We have to sacrifice that fantasy, and that takes some doing. It's also described as an inner presence that is an absence. I thought that was such an interesting way to describe that melancholy. An inner presence that is an absence, a light without representation. You can't speak of it because you've refused to consent to less than the fantasy. But if you hang on to it, you're devoted to it, it becomes a light without representation. It can't come out, it can't be spoken and seen. And yet it is a light, right?
Could you say that again, where you first spoke of the light?
A light without representation.
Light.
That can't have a symbolic expression, it can't be expressed.
There's no picture.
Yeah, because you're hiding it as a perfection. But that's not realized, so it's an absence, actually. The poor queen takes the shortcut and wants to accomplish this without sacrifice. Another language that I found for this was that you must sacrifice, you know, to become real in order to break the husk of the inflated ego's identity with the numinous. That makes sense, doesn't it? That it requires us to make some sacrifice in order to break that open and open the way for surrender and gratitude and a relationship with the numinous, both dark and light, right? The radiance of the dark as well as the daylight. If we follow this thread, it's really the story of our maturation in practice, isn't it? That rather than identifying with the numinous, which we do when we first sit down and we go, oh my gosh, look, I feel that emptiness. It's so beautiful, right? I want to just stay here for what happened. I lost it, you know. All of that, you know, from that identification to a relationship with, which is a real human thing with all of it. So here come our twins. You know, in mythology, twins you are often have an immortal father and immortal mother. As you guys pointed out along the way, she lives quite happily, right, with her beautiful son growing up. Forgetting the lindworm. And the lindworm, I was going to look up that I Ching reading. The lindworm is a threshold being, right? Out on the board, in the borderlands, right? At the edge of the kingdom, blocking the way. So if you think about the Buddha story, right? Where everything was perfect inside the compound, but you couldn't leave. Right? It's as if the lindworm is out there sort of guarding the gates so that you stay in your little perfect world, but suffering going on out there. And it's all fine until someone wants to leave, but the prince has to leave in order for any life to continue. So I was thinking about your beautiful story, Kelly, which I'd like you to type up. Because there's something interesting in there about that this particular tale doesn't follow what happens, but that had it not happened, and the prince had that perfect childhood and gone off to find the perfect bride and live on into the perfect kingdom, things might not have turned out so well for him either. So that's the sort of other side is of that interesting story. But in any case, here in the way it is, there's that turning, right? That big turning when the prince tries to leave, meets his brother, and goes back home as was pointed out, gently saying, what can you tell me about this? And that the lindworm is included, is not killed or thrust out. And so it feels to me as if in our practice we meet that time when, and we may meet, and you know, any story like this is not linear, right? It's circular. So that we, one again and again, we have to get to that border, meet the part that we didn't know about or forgot about that's been expelled in some way and not nourished. But hasn't died, has in fact grown very powerful in its own way by our not seeing, and is dark. And again, right, we get to meet the lindworm and hopefully bring it home. So, you know, when innocence has been blocked, a supposed innocence, sort of innocent ignorance, that kind, has been blocked inside, and doesn't, there's this big shattering of the status quo, right? And so rage erupts and might show up in our dreams, for example. And and so, you know, the lindworm's not happy about the situation and also is hungry, but is overtaken by out of control rage, yeah? Insult to the whole system that has happened, the trauma. You get the sense that the story as a whole kind of holds this, that the lindworm doesn't know what else to do, you know? Doesn't know what to do with a bride except eat. Then the next sort of turning that happens is the shepherd saying no, right? Not just going along with the program, but going, no, this is my only daughter, you know? I need her. And even though being overruled, there is that in us, that kind of, look, we've been getting along just fine here thing, that says, I don't want this sacrifice, right? This is too much. This is too hard. And you might know a time like that in your practice when you either are tempted to or you do turn away. And you go, you know, that sweet thing, you know, I liked that kind of fantasy practice. That was really lovely, but I seem to have lost that. And now this thing you're asking me to do is too hard. I have to give up this sense of who I was. I have to give up all of the coping mechanisms I've been getting along with. You know, they've been kind of working, you know. And yikes, what are you asking of me? And yet his daughter, who's accustomed to the fields and forests and has been serving, you know, as she's grown up, not a pampered princess, has guts. And she doesn't have to like it, but she's gonna have to grieve. She, you know, runs into the forest grieving and getting ripped by the thorns, and but she finds help, and she knows it when she finds it. And so here comes a real person. And she gets her instructions. And again, there's a choice, right? Are you going to do these things? You know, are you going to really follow through with this task? And as somebody pointed out, if she doesn't, she will die, which helps. but there's something about what she's taking on is to be willing to develop the ability to both love and hate, right, at the same time, to not have to like it. To not be alienated from everything that isn't easy. And there's something interesting about the crone there, that she holds the faith that the girl can do it, right? She says, no problem, honey, you can do this. And somebody has to do that for us, I think. Somebody has to help by holding the faith that we can do it. And then we get to that really beautiful moment when How am I doing here with time? Just a second. That really beautiful moment when the Lindworm says, "No one has ever asked that of me before."
That's pretty touching, too.
Yeah. And so if we think of that, in, you know, if we bring that sense into our own practice, you know, that moment when that thing within us, or that thing that we have put outside, shows us itself in a different way, its suffering. That it too is suffering. It too needs to be seen. That's the beginning of relationship. He has to shed, she has to be protected by those shifts. And he, there's a kind of mirroring. Was it you who talked about that? Somebody talked about how there's a kind of mirroring where they're both they're both seeing each other as they do this thing, and it takes both of them to do it. He has to endure a whipping. She has to give a whipping. Neither of which is going to be easy. And in a way, he, in order to be freed, he has to receive some of what he's been dealing out, is another way to see it. But and that interestingly, she must not be overcome by pity. And we've talked about this before, that if we over-identify with suffering, either our own or somebody else's, we're not very much use. So she has to be strong enough to do what must be done. And to really clean out the wound, right? You know, to debride the wound. I never noticed that. I don't know if the roots of those two are the same or not. So there again, you know, it's a ritual requirement, you know, and like us, you know, we must face the fraud that's being torn by crows. We must face things about how our lives are and others' lives are, or else we can't be useful. And in this time, we must face the suffering that's going on, of which we now have wider and wider awareness. We must be able to be, we have to tolerate its existence before we can be of any use. We have to be willing to do what must be done. And so this is where, you know, the fantasy is disillusioned. This is where the endarkenment goes, and where real relationship can happen. And I was thinking about this other koan that says, the sky doesn't come into the world to teach. Thinking about that crone who stays in the, she does not leave the forest, right? She doesn't come out and coach, right? And so that's kind of an interesting role. She stays, and as your story goes, he will stay there with his own intimate knowledge of suffering. And you don't know what the crone's intimate knowledge of suffering was, but you know she's got it. And wishing for a chance, you know, to help. So I hope that you can see the ways that all I've done is to gather the things that you, you know, to touch into the things that you already pointed out today, and that we've been talking about for quite some time, about how we transform our idealization of awakening into a maturity of being that allows us really to be in relationship with the dark and the light, not the good and the bad, right? That that in fact things are as they need to be in some sense in a human life. And that what you end up with in the story is quite ordinary, right? It's just a man and a woman. And the story doesn't go along to happily ever after, right? But you have two people who are probably ready to lead a real life. And that is a pretty sweet thing. Mm-hmm.